The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Mike Edwards for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Armchair Traveler. And for the next half hour, I will be reading to you from the National Geographic. Now, before we begin our journey on today's Armchair Traveler, please let me remind you that neither the North Carolina Reading Service nor I are endorsing any of the cruises, safaris, tours, or other travel itineraries that might be featured in the articles that we're going to be reading. These are selected simply for your enjoyment and edification. Today on Armchair Traveler, we visit a place that was once off-limits to outsiders, but as the editors of the January 2023 National Geographic article explained, the Himalayan Kingdom of Mustan is now opening to the world, but will its unique culture and priceless trove of Tibetan antiquity survive what's coming? That's the big question. Mark Sennett is our guide and author. And by the way, when you see this, Mustan is spelled M-U-S-T-A-N-G. We would say Mustang here in this country, but it is pronounced Mustan, just so you know. And occasionally, if I slip and say Mustang, you'll know that Mustan is what we're talking about, okay? And the title of the article, The King of Mustan Will See You Now. Dressed in well-worn jeans and a green fleece jacket, the king stood in the center of a low-ceilinged room in his centuries-old palace. He was reciting a Buddhist chant and methodically fingering a string of prayer beads. Around him, the walls and wooden pillars holding up the sagging roof were decorated with intricate paintings of Buddhist deities. Some wore gold robes and reclined blissfully. Others, wearing swords and surrounded by flames, howled with rage. It was mid-October and tucked away in this barren range of foothills on the northern edge of the Himalaya. The cold earthen walls of the drafty palace hinted at the onset of winter. A window offered a view of over the 600-year-old wall of the Lo Misteng, or Lo Armantan, is I should say, a historic capital of Nepal's fabled Mustan region, situated just 10 miles from the Chinese border. And just to give you an idea of how they spell and pronunciation, the Lo Mantan is spelled M-A-N-T-H-I-N-G, obviously T-H is pronounced one T, and Mantan, the historic capital of Nepal's famous Mustan region. So now you get the idea, don't you? Now, this is situated near the Chinese border, as we said. Tight rows of whitewashed mud brick and rammed earth buildings extend below. Smoke curled from the rooftops and groves of Himalayan poplars. Their luminous golden leaves near their peak shimmered in the afternoon breeze. To the southeast, braids of the Koli Gandaki River spread out like a fan across the valley, flowing toward an imposing wall of snow-capped peaks that gleamed against the deep blue sky. Such a view was once off-limits to foreigners like me. For much of the 20th century, access to Mustan was tightly controlled by the Nepali government. But now the king had brought me to his deteriorating palace to show me one of the many challenges his kingdom faces in the modern age. The king's full name is Jigme Singhi Palbar Bista, but he'd introduce himself simply as Jigme. He is slender, with thinning gray hair, and possesses an energy that belies the six decades. He's nimbly led me on a dimly lit obstacle course through the palace, which his family has been forced to leave after it was severely damaged during an earthquake in 2015. We'd climbed trembling wooden staircases, navigated gaping holes in the floor, and skirted crumbling walls decorated with mud-streaked murals. Despite the palace's decrepitude, the room where we now stood seemed to be extremely well-preserved. Jigme noticed me looking at the portrait of a man and a woman wearing traditional Tibetan robes, my parents, he said. This was my father's prayer room. He was the last king of Mustan, the 25th in our lineage. I am the 26th. To my left, a sandalwood cabinet covered in gold leaf stretched from floor to ceiling. Inside, a jumble of bronze figurines depicting Buddhist deities gazed out through the glass doors. A cluster of votive lamps burning yak butter filled the room with the distinctive smoky sour scent that imbues Buddhist temples across the Himalaya. Jigme explained that the figurines were more than just works of art. They were living spirits that have watched over his family since antiquity. Before placing each statue on the altar, he said, a high monk would perform a ritual to animate it with an enlightened body, speech, and mind. Now it is Jigme who watches over these deities, at least in their physical form. In the secular world, a black market antiquities dealer could sell this small collection for a sizable fortune. For centuries, the idea of someone taking them was of little worry here in this isolated, devoutly Buddhist city. But the outside world finally had ascended to Mustin's doorstep, and art theft was just one of many new things the king had to worry about. As Jigme and I shared this quiet moment in his prayer room, I could just make out the low rumble of earth-moving equipment improving the road that approaches the city from the south. The nearly 300-mile journey from Nepal's capital, Kathmandu, which once required weeks either on foot or on the back of a horse or yak, can now be completed, albeit not by the faint of heart, in just 3 days of driving. Vehicles, preferably with four-wheel drive, traverse a dizzying series of switchbacks on a rough, narrow track carved along the cliffs lining the Kali Gandaki Gorge. During my journey, it was delayed by landslides that blocked the route for hours, leaving a winding line of cars stranded across the cliff face. Nevertheless, the road is a paradigm-shifting improvement for the people of Mustin, allowing for the flow of the cheap goods and easier access to modern medical facilities, among many other conveniences. The stream of goods and people may soon become a surging river of commerce. To the north, the Chinese have anticipated a lucrative new trade route and are waiting with freshly paved road that connects their side of the border with highways that lead all the way to Beijing. What remains is to join the roads, and a new era of trade can begin in this legendary corner of the roof of the world. The question for Jigme and the people of Mustin is whether they can preserve the parts of this tiny kingdom that for centuries have made it special. Around us, the painted deities smiled and snarled. Jigme sat down on a bench and lowered his eyes. I thought he might be meditating or praying, but then, with a quick motion, he pulled out his iPhone and checked his messages. It would be fitting for Mustin to become once again a hub for trade. The palace Jigme had shown me was a relic of the city's golden age, dating back to the 15th century. At that time, the upper portion of the region was known as the Kingdom of Lo. Its people, the Lopa, ethnic cousins of Tibetans, had amassed great wealth by controlling trade through the Kali Gandaki Valley. Flanked to the west on the world's seventh highest peak, the Dalagara, one, which is 26,795 feet, and on the east by the 10th highest, Annapurna, 26,545 feet, the gorge offered one of the most direct trading routes between the rich salt deposits of the Tibetan Plateau and the markets of India. Here the Lopa taxed the yak caravans, which, in addition to salt, carried barley, turquoise, and the glands of musk deer used for medicine and perfume. The name Mustin derives from the Tibetan word meaning plain of desire, a reference to the potential riches to be gleaned there. But even before Mustin had evolved into a vibrant trading hub, it had been an important crossroads for Buddhist scholars and pilgrims moving between India and China. Eventually, Buddhist teachings were fused with the region's animistic practices, and the Tibetan Buddhism was born. Over time, the kingdom embraced this new faith and built ornate temples and monasteries according to the local legend. The first Tibetan Buddhist temple in the kingdom was constructed just a few miles south of Lomentan by an Indian mystic who destroyed a demoness there. Today, this temple, known as Logekar, sits along a stand of twisted willow trees at the end of an isolated canyon where locals believe it still pins down the heart of the slain demoness. By the 18th century, with powerful states rising on Mustin's borders, the King of Lo traveled to meet the King of the newly united Nepal. Jigme described how his predecessor brought offerings of milk, mustard seeds, and soil to demonstrate that Mustin had land and wealth to share. Impressed by the gesture, the Nepali king offered Mustin protection in exchange for nominal taxes and an annual tribute. Two centuries later, this affiliation would save Mustin from the ravages of China's control of Tibet, which began shortly after Mao Zedong invaded in 1950. Over the next decade, as thousands of Buddhist sites in Tibet were closed, Mustin's treasures remained untouched. But the kingdom's isolation wouldn't prevent it from getting pulled headlong into the Cold War. In the early 1960s, a secret army of CIA-trained Tibetan guerrillas trekked into Mustin. Supported by U.S. airdrops of arms, supplies, and trained radio operators, they planned to launch cross-border raids on the Chinese army and then set up bases in Tibet. Despite capturing some important intelligence documents, they achieved little and were disarmed by the Nepali government in 1974. The political fallout led the Nepali government to seal the region more tightly than ever before. This was the world in which Jigme was raised, a forbidden kingdom isolated among some of the planet's most forbidding terrain. As king, his father kept an eye on the border, but his primary job was to keep the peace. He traveled constantly between villages, settling local quarrels and disputes over property. He rarely spent even 2 days at home, Jigme told me. He would hear of a problem or a fight, jump on his horse, and go there. His word was the final say in the kingdom. When he wasn't settling disputes, the king oversaw religious ceremonies. One of the most important is a lavish 3-day festival known as Tagji, where dozens of monks, hidden under ferocious masks, dance before the king in a square just outside the palace in the Low Mentan to celebrate the triumph of good over evil. When he was 21 years old, Jigme left Mustin to attend college in Kathmandu. Each winter, his father would visit, making the 3-week journey across the mountains as his ancestors had done to honor the treaty with the Nepali king. He'd bring local products for the king, wool, carpets, blankets, and horses, Jigme said. And while he was there, he would reconcile accounts for how government funds were spent and ask for money for new projects. Things began to change in 2008. After a decade of civil war, Nepal adopted a new constitution, reinventing itself as a federal republic. All monarchies were abolished, and Jigme's father was stripped of his official position. Suddenly, the role for which Jigme had been preparing was eliminated, at least officially. It didn't upset me, Jigme said. I recognized that times were changing and had my own life to focus on. We were never proud of our position, and we didn't receive any compensation for it, so we accepted it. After his father passed away in 2016, Jigme was thrust into an awkward position. Most of the Lopa regarded him as the rightful king, but one with no official power. Yet they still depended on him to lead religious rituals and occasionally to adjudicate local disputes. And the people's veneration of him is plain. Earlier in the day, as we walked through the narrow alleyways of Low Mentan, everyone we passed reverently removed their hats and bowed their heads to him. Jigme, smiling and jovial, greeted each person by name. So how does a king, who has no real power or authority, preserve his kingdom's cultural heritage? Jigme's decaying palace is just one example of the challenges he faces. Said to have been built in 1441 by the son of Amapaul, the legendary first king of Mustin, it's listed by UNESCO as a potential World Heritage Site, but due to damage from the earthquake and an increasingly wet climate, it needs extensive funds just to prevent further decay. Meanwhile, beyond the walls of Low Mentan is the kingdom's numerous valleys and canyons, which hold more ancient palaces and temples, each inhabited by its own deities and filled with its own treasures. I'd heard about one particular site, an abandoned Buddhist nunnery called Gampa Gang, which sits on a bluff above the Kali Gandaki River, midway up the valley. The next morning before sunrise, Jigme's cousin, Teswan Jandabista, and I set off to see it. With the landscape coming alive in the early light, we drove along the Kali Gandaki as it flowed lazily across a wide plain and past foothills stratified into a layer cake of grays, browns, yellows, and reds. Herds of shaggy pashmina goats trotted alongside the road, tended by dust-covered teenagers, boys and girls. Terraced fields lined the fertile land along the river. It was harvest time, and whole families, children included, were headed into green fields of buckwheat and orchards brimming with apples. We parked at the base of a towering mud cliff. High above, its face was pitted with dozens of dark, window-like openings. Swing, who runs a trekking company, switched to tour guide mode and explained that Mustin is famous for these mysterious sky caves. Thousands of them are bored into cliffs along the across the region. Carbon dating suggests that some were excavated more than a millennium ago. In 2008, a National Geographic team managed to access a cave 700 feet above the ground inside. They found a large room containing thousands of manuscripts with Buddhist and pre-Buddhist writing and imagery. Other caves held skeletons, but no one knows exactly who dug them or why they went to such lengths to create these caches. We made our way up a trail to a ridge overlooking the river. There, a thick grove of willows surrounded a whitewashed earthen structure. We pushed open an iron gate and walked into the courtyard. A weathered prayer flag was mounted on a wooden pole driven into a pile of stones and bleached yak horns. The flag snapped in the wind as Swing explained how, during the nunnery's zenith in the 1700s, pilgrims traveled to this site from all over India, Nepal, and Tibet to pray and receive blessings. As Mustin's prosperity waned, the nunnery fell silent into disrepair. We stepped through a low door into the main hall, where a colossal two-story statue of the Maitreya Buddha dominated the room. Its head extended through an opening in the ceiling into a second-floor chamber, where rays of sunlight illuminated its face. Swang explained that his incarnation of the Buddha represents a future teacher who will spread wisdom across the world after a long period of famine and war. Swang also shined a flashlight into the wall, and I saw the room was covered in murals. One depicted a Buddha who sat cross-legged atop a cloud beside a bare-breasted woman, holding a conch shell in one hand and offering a silver bowl in the other. There were endless figures setting complex and colorful. In it faded scenes as we worked our way through the darkness, Swang pointed his light to images representing the cosmos, the wheel of life, and hundreds of deities. There is Guru Rinpoche, he said, illuminating a figure in blue and red robes, the principal founder of Tibetan Buddhism, who is believed to have traveled through Mustin in the 8th century. Upon closer inspection, I noticed that many of the paintings were disintegrating. One was riddled with pockmarks. Another was furrowed with cracks, and in places the plaster bulged like a blister. For centuries, this region near the Tibetan plateau got little rain, but the climate here is changing rapidly, and the rammed earth structure is facing moisture levels it never was designed to handle. In the past, the rain and melting snow would only soak through one layer of bricks, Swan said. Now the storms are fewer but stronger. Today, or rather sometimes, we'll get a winter's worth of snow in one spring storm. When it melts all at once, as been issued during the year, the paces remain slow until now. But Jigme is confident that it will soon change. And while Nepal is famous for Mount Everest expeditions, much of the country's half-billion-dollar tourism sector is driven by trekkers and religious pilgrims for whom Mustin is a special appeal. Mustin, Jigme noted, offers a particular landscape but also a window into Tibetan culture that is largely evaporated elsewhere. Despite Jigme's optimistic outlook, it seemed that the return on this sizable investment was still a long way off. At that moment, Swang and I were the hotel's only guest, and Jigme isn't the only one banking on tourism. At the time of my visit, there were dozens of hotels in Lomentin, a town with only 1,300 official residents. And Mustin's harsh climate makes visiting feasible for only about 6 months each year. Winter temperatures regularly drop far below zero, freezing pipes and making hotel toilets inoperable. During the summer, landslides triggered by monsoons often block the roads for weeks. While Jigme hopes the road will bring people to Lomentin, it makes it easier for the town's dwindling population to leave. Over the past several years, young adults have been departing in droves to seek their fortunes in Kathmandu, Japan, Korea, and the United States. The valley's economy has long relied on the large herds of goats and yaks, but now that brutal work is rapidly losing its appeal. By one count, more than 2,000 Lopa live in New York City, which is more than the entire population of Lomenton. If this trend continues, Chicamy predicts the region will lose 80% of its population over the next 20 years. The picture has been further muddled as the promise of tourism has spurred rampant land speculation. There was once an unwritten rule that Lopa could not sell property to outsiders, Chicamy explained, but as values skyrocket, this taboo has been ignored. Chicamy told me that a single acre of rock-strewn pasture not far from where we sat had recently sold for $700,000. Can you blame a farmer who only makes $700 a year for selling out and moving to Kathmandu or New York City? He asked. I had mentioned to Chicamy that I wanted to visit the Chinese border, so one morning he sent Shuang and me off in a 4x4. We traveled along a smooth gravel road that led us northward toward a range of brown hills, their crests dusted with snow. After an hour, we rolled up to a Nepali army checkpoint. A young soldier saw me in the back seat, frowned, and said something in Nepali. He says that foreigners aren't allowed to visit the border, Shuang said. This is new since the last time I was here. Well, we turned around, and a few miles back down the road, we stopped for noodles at a small restaurant. The proprietor, when he heard the story, said that there wasn't an alternate path to the border, and I can show you, he said. Soon he and I were speeding along a dusty trail on the man's motorbike, me on the back, my arms wrapped tightly around his leather jacket, heading north as we ascended rutted switchbacks that led us up over the Corolla at 15,290 feet. A couple of miles beyond the pass, the road abruptly ended at a barbed wire fence stretching across the barren land as far as we could see. The wind howled. Broken beer bottles and plastic wrappers littered the ground. A sign in English read, "No parking in the no man's land and no photography." Some Nepali tourists, who'd arrived also by motorbike, ignored the sign and took selfies around a squat concrete pillar that marked the Nepal-China border. A few hundred feet behind the fence on the Chinese side, three monolithic buildings, each roughly the size of a Walmart and clad in what appeared to be white marble, completely blocked our view to the north. Numerous video cameras mounted on metal poles pointed in our direction. Later, I found satellite images that revealed what lay beyond the giant marble buildings, structures that locals said were military barracks, and a long black ribbon of pavement heading north across the Tibetan Plateau. It's no coincidence that Nepal's road-building boom is occurring concurrently with Chinese President Xi Jinping's Belt and Road Initiative, a massive infrastructure campaign designed to expand China's economic and political influence from East Asia all the way to Europe. When complete, it will include multiple roads across the Himalaya, but also, perhaps none rather, will offer a more direct route to India than the one I had just followed from Kathmandu to this spot on the border. Also weighing in the background is the 2014 discovery of a large deposit of uranium in Mustin. China is rapidly building nuclear plants to meet its growing energy needs and carbon reduction pledges. Though no mines have opened yet, it seems logical that at some point uranium will become another of Mustin's coveted treasures. That evening, Chicamy invited me to dinner at the Royal Mustin Resort. Next to our table, a propane heater warded off the hill in the dining room, decorated with Tibetan paintings and cipiated photographs of the royal family. As we ate, Chicamy predicted that within a few years, the Chinese would build a business park on the Corolla with Western-style hotels, casinos, and maybe an airport. Tourism will grow massively, he said, and a boom in tourism and industry might be exactly what Mustin needs, but, he acknowledged, could also bring a tsunami of outside influences that might subsume what it means to be Lopa. Yet it was a risk every Lopa I spoke with felt they had to accept. In order to save our culture, we need tourism, Chicamy said, and in order to have tourism, we need the road. On my last morning in Mustin, I met Chicamy for breakfast at his hotel. Over coffee and eggs, he told me that he had something special to show me. Like many people in Mustin, Chicamy was reluctant to share information about his own artifacts. To date, he told me he hadn't allowed anyone to see the treasures passed down to him from his royal family's his family's royal dynasty. He took me to a location I promised not to reveal. We opened a creaky wooden door in the floor, leading to a crude stairway. We clicked on headlamps, and I carefully followed Chicamy down to a windowless room. We had to crouch to avoid hitting our heads on the hand-hewn beams. The air was stale and heavy with dust. Jigme lit a single yak butter lamp, and out of the darkness a row of almost life-size bronze statues appeared, a pantheon of deities decorated with gold, silver, turquoise, and coral. They glowed in the yellow light. In the shadows beyond, I could see the rest of the room was filled with dusty wooden boxes, like cargo stacked in the hold of a ship. "I've inherited all this," said Jigme with a sweep of his hand, "and I have to do something great with it. I'm showing you because my dream is to create a living museum where I can display these items and keep them alive. Then someday I can hand it over to my children. But that takes a lot of money, which I don't have," laughing. He added, "What I really need is a dollar machine." For the moment, there was nothing for Jigme to do but pray and hope that he can somehow find a way to protect what he has. Maybe the road will eventually bring enough tourists to fill his hotel and can become a dollar machine he needs to preserve his family's treasures. None of this seemed to weigh too heavily on Jigme as he approached the statues and bowed his head to light a second lamp. As he prayed softly in Tibetan, I wondered if he felt the body, speech, and mind of those ancient deities flowing into him, like they once might have done into the Mustan kings before him. As the wick crackled and the flame cast dark forms on the crumbling walls around us, I thought about this kingdom, not just its historical treasures, but also the mesmerizing grandeur of its wild landscape and soul-calming calmness, or stillness. There's so much here to preserve, and even more to lose. Interesting story about a place called Mustan in Nepal. Well, just to give you kind of a inside look here, the journey to Lomentin, featured by photographs with Francois Bianco, and some of the captions give us an idea more of what's going on here. Lomentin, a village in the restricted territory of Upper Mustan, used to be capital of the Kingdom of Lo. Nepali law now requires foreign visitors to purchase a permit, that's $500 U.S. for 10 days, to enter Upper Mustan to help preserve the local culture and development in the region. But this does not mean Lomentin is inaccessible. Foreign travelers must also travel with a guide, and there are a few ways to get to Lomentin, and while you may be able to rent bikes and jeeps in Mustan, it's better to do this in Pokhara. Motorbike. With road expansions throughout Nepal in recent years, the roads to Lomentin are now accessible by motorized vehicle. On a heavy-duty motorbike, it's possible to get to Lomentin in a matter of days from Jompsan. Bikes like Royal Enfield's Pulsars, which are over 200cc engine size, and Hartford VRs are popular choices. Starting from Pokhara, first make your way toward Jansum, a journey of 2 days with a stop at Tepanani, and from Tepanani, I should say, continue to Jansum or Kegbeni for the next day. The checkpoint for the Upper Mustan permits at Kegbeni. From here, ride to Gami for 6 to 7 hours, and the next day to Lomentin. The roads are not paved, so it's important to be cautious in this rugged landscape. You can also take a jeep to get to Lomentin by jeep. You rent one from Pokhara or Kegbeni. From Pokhara, it would be preferable because you can arrange it together with a permit and a guide. And then trekking. While trekking to Lomentin is slower than the other options, it's worth it to explore the quiet, empty land. And on day one, you'll walk from Cheli to Kegbeni, which takes 6 to 7 hours. And the writer says, I suggest spending at least 2 full days in Lomentin before making your way back down. The return trip's going to take 3 days, either stopping at the same villages as on the way up, or instead stopping at Gekar, Gami, Gasusang, and Kegbeni. So there you go. And that concludes today's episode of Armchair Traveler. Hope you've enjoyed our journey and that you'll be with us next time. I'm Mike Edwards, and I've been reading for the North Carolina Reading Service and reminding you the content of the program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Armchair Traveler is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. That's ncreadingservice.org. If you have any questions or comments, please call 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.